Every year, tens of thousands of dogs, mostly beagles, are used as tools in deadly research experiments. Join me, your host, Ellie Hansen, as we dive into this issue and talk to all the awesome people out there trying to make a difference for these dogs. Best of all, find out what you can do to help. We're opening doors for discussion and shedding light on the facts. This is Dog Research Exposed. Mahatma Gandhi once said, "Remember that all through history, there have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time, they seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always." This episode is dedicated to all the survivors of Invigo, the nearly 4,000 beagles who were rescued by the Humane Society of the United States during the summer of 2022. It's also dedicated to the many thousands of dogs who were sold to research facilities, who never got the chance to really live, to be the dogs they were born to be, our companions and our best friends. History was made during the summer of 2022. The massive research beagle breeding facility in Virginia called Invigo was officially shut down due to the large amount of animal welfare violations uncovered from inside. In the history of vivisection, rarely are entire facilities closed and all the dogs or other animals inside set free. But it happened with Invigo, and we should never forget it, because this story has the power to inspire other stories just like it. In this episode, we get an in-depth look at how the Humane Society of the United States carried out the Invigo rescue operation. It was a feat accomplished in a miraculously short period of time, including thousands of people and hundreds of rescue organizations from around the nation. Lindsay Hamrick is the Director of Shelter Outreach and Engagement for the Humane Society of the United States. She was in charge of placing the nearly 4,000 beagles safely in the hands of rescue organizations around the country. Lindsay joins us today to reflect on the enormousness of this rescue and how HSUS is now even better prepared to take on another project like this when it happens again in this special episode of Dog Research Exposed. I've read basically every article about this rescue I could get my hands on. All those news articles showing the photos of hundreds and hundreds of beagles and beagles in crates lined up on the airport runway. All the videos showing the nonstop work of HSUS staff and volunteers taking care of these thousands of dogs and puppies. And you were instrumental in all of that. So I'm really curious how a dog rescue of this magnitude is actually planned and executed. The news articles didn't really go into detail on that, but we're going to do that now. For example, when were you first made aware of the fact that you were now in charge of placement for nearly 4,000 dogs, which is the largest dog rescue in U.S. history? And do you remember how you reacted to this news and how you felt about it?
You know, it's funny now that it's been almost 2 years, which is kind of crazy that it's been that long. So I don't know if I had said this in previous conversations around 2022 or 2023, but both myself and my staff person, there was only two of us that did all of the logistical planning for the shelter partner program. We were both closing on new houses that summer, and like our personal lives were very all over the place. So it was right before 4th of July weekend, and it was a Friday night. I was driving hours away from where I used to live because I was moving my dogs. My car was full of all the things. And we had this urgent mandatory call at HSUS. And I sort of knew it could be about this, but I wasn't sure. My team often works with the animal rescue team, so it really could be anything. So I pulled over on the side of the road as I was driving up north in New England, where I live. And we had a conversation about how this agreement had just been signed, that the Department of Justice had reached out and asked HSUS for our support in placing what they assumed would be about 4,000 beagles, and that we needed to get it done in 60 days. And so I was sitting on the side of the road. My dogs were waiting patiently in the car. And I just listened, trying to understand exactly what our requirements were going to be, how we were going to, what parts we were going to be responsible for, and what parts Department of Justice and USDA and others would be involved in. Then I messaged my staff person and one other person that was critical to the placement efforts. And I said, please enjoy your 4th of July weekend, because when we all get back on Tuesday, we're going to be very busy. So that's what we all did. We spent 4th of July weekend just kind of resettling and trying to enjoy ourselves. I would say that I felt it was a mixed emotion initially. It was part really celebratory emotions that these particular dogs were going to be able to have a different outcome. And we thought going into it that it would truly be a watershed moment for animal research issues, but we don't ever know that until we really go through it. And I also just personally felt very overwhelmed by the idea of placing all of these animals in 60 days. And it, I knew that our success or not was going to be entirely dependent on whether or not our shelter and rescue partners could absorb that volume of dogs in that quick of a time frame. And so that was a very big unknown that we would not know for at least a couple of weeks.
So the rescue officially started in July of 2022 when the HSUS Animal Rescue Team started transporting the beagles to shelter and rescue partners across the country. And by September 1st, all the 3,776 beagles were on their way to loving homes. As the HSUS Director of Shelter Outreach and Engagement, you worked directly with the animal rescue team to find these placements for the beagles. Can you explain the logistics of this coordinated effort? For example, how did you begin the process of finding placements for the dogs? It seems so overwhelming, and yet I'm sure that HSUS had a system that you followed.
So the good news is this is not a new thing for us to do in terms of the way that we reach out to shelter and rescue partners for help. What was unique about it was the volume of animals and the time frame. And of course, because we were going to be on site at Envigo removing animals, there were some additional logistics that we usually don't need to deal with. Usually, in a situation where the animal rescue team is requested, they are going onto a scene one time with law enforcement, removing the animals, and then we are moving them off of that property. But obviously, with 4,000 dogs, we couldn't remove them all in one day. So there were variables to this that we had never faced, but the structure of what we do, what we always do, wasn't necessarily different. So in a normal situation, we would email a select group of partners within our network. And the Humane Society of the United States has over 400 shelters and rescues in our program that at least are willing to receive communication from us when we need assistance. They are never under any obligation to accept animals. We want shelters and rescues to know what their capacity to care is. We don't want them to take in our animals if they themselves are overwhelmed. So that is usually our process. But in this scenario, we knew we had to reach out to every single partner. We weren't going to limit it from a geographic perspective. We weren't going to limit the number of partners that could help. And so we set up a survey the very next week that we sent to every single partner on our list. And we said in that survey, please tell us, are you interested in receiving some of these animals? If so, what time frame do you think would work for you within the 60 days? It's important to remember that the summer of 2022 was it was a crisis for shelters and rescues, and it continues to be to this day. Many shelters across the country are still overwhelmed with animals who are not moving quickly into new homes, and it's created this multi-year backlog of animals in shelters. And so the timing from a shelter placement perspective was very bad. It was summertime when most shelters are already very busy. So in this survey, we asked them to tell us if they were interested, what time frame might work, and importantly, whether they had the capacity to drive to Envigo to pick up the dogs themselves or to come to our care center to do that. And we don't always need shelter partners to drive to us, but because our animal rescue team was so heavily involved in being on scene at Envigo, caring for hundreds of dogs at our care center, we knew that the transportation itself was going to be a barrier. Then we spent about a week analyzing all the results from that survey, starting to put together what a calendar would look like, talking constantly with the animal rescue team, the Department of Justice, because we also didn't know how often we'd be able to go to Envigo to remove dogs, which would affect how often we could get dogs to partners. So it felt like forever before we finally got there and had the team on scene at Envigo, but it was really only a couple of weeks. So the first transfer of dogs happened on July 21st, which was about 10 days or so, 10 or 12 days after we had put everything in place. And we prioritized, especially for the first month, we prioritized the partners that could take large groups of dogs that could transport those animals themselves so that we could focus on our work at the care center. So it was both similar to other placements that we've done and also incredibly unique because of all the different moving parts.
Where was the ATSUS Care Center? Was it at your headquarters or was it near where Envigo was?
So we have a rehabilitation and care center that we utilize for all kinds of situations. I can't disclose where it is, but it is set up to be essentially a temporary landing place for animals that our team responds to. So it had the capability of holding a few hundred of these dogs at a time, especially since we knew the beagles that came to our care center were going to leave pretty quickly and go on to be with partners. I think in the end, we had about a third of the beagles came through our care center within those 2 months. So that involved the shelter team, it involved veterinarians at our center, it involved a mass of volunteers to do daily care to make sure that we were able to get all those dogs onto transport so that we could empty kennels, get the next round in. It was a fairly well-oiled machine by the time we were done.
I believe that there were a lot of female beagles that were pregnant when you rescued them. So, does that number, 3,776, include those born after leaving Envigo, or were there actually more than 3,776 total, not including the puppies?
So this was something that surprised me because I also went into this assuming Envigo is a breeding facility for beagles that are used in animal testing. So we had to be clear with partners that these were not dogs that were in laboratories being tested on yet, which made us assume that there'd be pregnant females. And in fact, there weren't. The reason there were not pregnant females is because the Department of Justice had put in place a temporary order on Envigo that required them to stop breeding the dogs. And so a dog's gestation is about 2 months. And by the time we started pulling dogs on July 21st, it had already been about 2 months since that injunction had gone into place. So there were mother beagles with young puppies, with 6-week-old puppies, but there actually were not any pregnant female dogs because of that order, which made it a little bit easier. And we did prioritize at the end of July, the dogs that we moved first were the moms and puppies, and they were any adult beagle that Envigo had marked as having significant medical needs. We wanted to make sure those dogs were removed quickly.
So there was a bit of a media frenzy surrounding this rescue story. And these dogs were coming from a very unique and complicated situation. So I'm sure you had to be pretty particular about who you handed these dogs off to in terms of your shelter partners. So how did you choose the shelter partners you ended up working with?
Yeah, great question. So the variety of organizations in our program range from large municipal shelters that do a lot of animal control work to foster-based rescue groups that might handle even just 20 dogs a year. In this scenario, what we told, I mean, some of our groups had dealt with beagles from situations like this in the past, so that was obviously very simple. And in fact, the groups that we utilized first were the ones who had had experience with these kinds of dogs. So, because we wanted to, number one, we knew that they would have a little bit more experience with how complicated this was going to be, we could trust them to be on scene and not take selfies and not mess up that part of the operation, but also they could use their previous expertise to tell us if those dogs were similar to dogs that they had helped in the past. But we did utilize a significant number of partners who had never had beagles from research come into their facilities. And the reason that that worked fine is because these dogs very much, they had a lot of similarities to puppy mill dogs, right? They were living in kennels, they were being used for breeding, and most of our partners have some experience with puppy mills. So we gave them, information. There was some fact sheets for partners to consider. As the dogs began to be removed, we would share information with partners. So if one shelter found some kind of medical condition, we would want other shelters to know about that. But by and large, the organizations felt like, other than fearful based behaviors, which we would expect from this environment, that their adopter pools seemed very knowledgeable and interested in helping these dogs. We trust our partners to work with the public to relay information so that the matches can be as good as they can be. We also recognize that this was a fast operation, so we're not necessarily going to know in 60 days everything about these dogs. Whereas with most of our responses, especially with dogs that are struggling behaviorally, we may hold on to them at our HSUS care center for months before we even do placement because we want to learn who they are and what they need. So this was a unique situation in that regard. There were a handful of partners that received beagles, then summer got even crazier for them, and they felt like they could not keep the animals that they had taken in. And we had been very clear with everyone that if that happened, to reach out to us, we would work to move them someplace else, or they could network with partners they trusted to move those animals. So that only happened a handful of times. And we were so glad that they reached out because we don't want a shelter to have animals from one of our responses and to be overwhelmed. So yeah, I think, there were groups that had a ton of experience with animal research issues, and there were groups that had never done this work before. And much like the volume of adopters who are now aware of animal research issues, we now have so many more shelters and rescues that are passionate about this issue because they received dogs from this case.
You had a 60-day time frame to rescue and place 3,776 dogs. The reason for this urgent deadline was, and I'm going to quote you here, because the dogs were suffering. There was an emotional urgency to moving them. Can you explain the statement in more detail?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that the Department of Justice intervened, right? This was a situation where animals had died at that facility, where medical care, the notes about medical care were not ideal. There were issues around sanitation and the living conditions of these dogs. And so anytime law enforcement is involved in a any kind of cruelty or neglect situation or something like this, obviously, we want to act as quickly as we possibly can. And while it wasn't realistic to get everybody out within something shorter than 60 days, and honestly, 60 days felt very aggressive just from a placement perspective, we're just so happy that we were able to get it done in that short of a period of time because it meant that those dogs could go to partners, they could be seen by veterinarians, they could be put on medical treatment plans if they needed to be, they could be moved into foster homes if they needed some support before adoption, they could be moved into adoptive homes and be given the behavior and medical support that they needed there. So, you know, in the end, those animals really needed that change of scenery in a different environment.
What was a typical day like for you during the months of the Envigo rescue?
Well, I would wake up and I would try to take my dogs for a hike because I knew I wasn't going to pay attention to them the rest of the day. And it was a combination of internal planning calls, conversations with partners, media interviews. I myself, so I work remotely usually, and I never went down to the facility. I never went down to our care center because there was so much administrative work that was required that there was not time for me or my colleague to deploy and assist the way we might in a different kind of situation. Very long days, constant troubleshooting. So thinking through this worked well, this didn't work well. We're getting feedback from partners, we're getting feedback from federal agents, we're getting feedback from our own animal rescue team, getting feedback from the shelter team at the HSUS Care Center. How do we improve every single week so that everybody is getting everything that they need? The good news is everyone knew that this was a monumental undertaking. And so I don't think any of our partners, any of our internal staff, any of the law enforcement that we worked with, nobody was asking for perfection here. We were just trying to make sure that we were all doing the best by the dogs. And so now we all can look back and say, and look at protocols that worked really well and things that we wouldn't do again. And if and when it ever happens again, you know, we have the guidebook on how to get it done. So it feels good to say that.
I'm going to quote you here again. In an interview about the rescue, you said, "There was such an outpouring of support and a real flexibility. This was a very unique operation that we had very little control over, but shelters and rescues figured it out." Can you describe what you meant by having little control and what exactly the shelters and rescues had to deal with that was so unique?
Yes. So we could not control necessarily which dates we could go to Envigo and remove dogs. So our animal rescue team was at the Envigo facility for each removal of the dogs. We wanted to make sure that we had trained staff at least doing a visual check on every dog as it left, because we didn't want, if there were any dogs who needed immediate medical care, we didn't want to just put them right on a shelter partner vehicle without a plan, et cetera. But we didn't know how often we were going to be able to be there. The Envigo veterinarian needed to sign health certificates for all of these dogs, regardless of where they were going, which meant that about 10 to 14 days before every time that the dogs were removed, my team had to send them exactly which partners were receiving dogs that day, exactly how many dogs, so that the paperwork could be filled out legally for the animals to be moved. So there was so much paperwork that was needed to do this right. We also couldn't control things like how many dogs we could remove each time. On average, there were days that we removed about 250 dogs from Envigo. There were some days that we removed almost 500. It just depended on a variety of things. Because we allowed some shelter and rescue partners to actually go on the property of Envigo to help to be there so that their vehicles could be filled up, there were a lot of requirements for partners because this was an ongoing investigation. And so we had to make sure that they understood all of those rules. And then what I would say about shelter and rescue flexibility, in a normal situation, HSUS would take in a group of animals. We would have our veterinarian do full examinations, vaccinations, heartworm testing, parasite treatment or preventative. And if there was anything medically or behaviorally that needed additional attention, we would do that before we ever reached out to partners. In this scenario, especially in the beginning, we said to them, we don't know. We don't know if you're going to get, we don't know if you're going to get males or females. We don't know what age you're getting unless we knew it was litters of puppies. We don't know how much medical care they might need depending on the group you got. Some shelter partners got all female adult dogs. Some shelter partners got all male dogs because of the building that they were being pulled from the day of that operation. So I am just so impressed and satisfied and thrilled that our partners were as flexible as they were. They were like, we don't care. Just whatever dogs we can help and how many of them we can help find homes for and provide medical care to, we will do that. What I would also say was tricky about this is every state has a little bit of a different regulatory system around transport of animals into their state. So we know which states require things like heartworm testing or that dogs need to be heartworm negative. We know which states require an additional vaccination beyond distemper and rabies. So that created sort of some complexity around how much was Envigo able to do before the dogs could leave versus how much we needed to layer on so that those partners could receive the dogs in their states.
As an Envigo adopter myself, I am now deeply involved in the world of Envigo beagles, which has become a movement of sorts. We call our beagles e-beagles. Entire Facebook pages are dedicated to Envigo beagle adopters. I feel like this rescue has inspired a cultural shift because people who never knew dogs were used for testing now do. Envigo beagle adopters are meeting each other and arranging Envigo beagle meetups and reunions around the country. And many Envigo adopters really want to know, did my beagle's brothers, sisters, mother, or father make it out of Envigo alive too? So you were talking about all that paperwork earlier. How or did you or were you able to keep records of the nearly 4,000 dogs? And is this paperwork available to help any of these adopters in their search for their beagle's family members in some way?
Well, first, I would just say thank you for adopting one of the dogs from this. I feel like this thing happens in animal welfare where it's almost like the public thinks we've solved an issue earlier than it actually was solved. I feel like that happened with sort of trophy hunting with wildlife. It happened with the way circuses treat wild animals. And so there's this thing that happens where the public's like, didn't we already do that? Like, really, beagles are still getting tested on? And I think that's this issue falls under as well. And I completely agree with you that not only do we have so many local organizations, we also have, whether somebody adopted one of these dogs or not, there was so much media coverage for such a long period of time that it feels like, and we're seeing this in state legislatures. So, not to go on a quick tangent here about policy, but the Humane Society of the United States, we've been dedicated to this issue for decades. And the openness of some state legislatures to look at this issue again and to take it seriously because of this removal of these dogs has really, I mean, I agree with you. There's been this huge shift in awareness, in advocacy, and passion behind this issue. So thank you to all of your listeners who might have adopted or just, they're now engaging legislatively on this issue. As far as records, one of the things that I would say about this is sort of similar in that it is unique in the situations we're in. So most of our animal rescue team responses are a private property, law enforcement is serving a warrant, animals are being removed, there's almost never any paperwork. There's almost never veterinary records, et cetera. The paperwork that partners would get from us would be the work we did with those animals before they moved on to their programs. Envigo, we only received those health certificates as the only consistent paperwork that was received by any of us. And because two-thirds of the dogs were picked up directly from the facility, the partners would have received those health certificates directly. If any other paperwork was with the dogs, I wouldn't expect it to be a lot. There was a lot of internal paperwork for HSUS, but it wasn't coming from the facility. We made sure of the third of the dogs that came through the care center, we made sure that we passed along any paperwork we had, which is usually a health certificate. So, unfortunately, we don't have a ton of documentation on these dogs. And I know that It's probably frustrating to folks who have adopted and just want to be able to connect the dots to not know. But honestly, we see this a lot in puppy mill situations where, we are working with hundreds of animals who have been bred, tons of puppies. We end up placing them, and folks will not know where those animals, where their siblings came from, because we may end up sending dogs to different partners in a geographic area. So what we have said to adopters since the beginning is to reach out to the group that you adopted from, because they will have as much paperwork as HSUS has. We didn't withhold any paperwork from partners. Some partners have been able to give information to adopters that's helped them to connect some dots. Other partners either don't have the bandwidth to be able to go back through it, or they may be under their own legal counsel not to release anything, not necessarily because there's a legal mandate around it, but because it was an investigation, and so it was a complicated operation. And so we defer to partners about their comfort level with releasing what they needed to. But even for the groups that have released everything they had, I don't know that it's ever going to be enough to make all the connections for folks with the dogs that they're looking for.
I imagine being able to see the dogs and where they are today is quite emotional for you. Can you describe how you feel about the Envigo rescue now, 2 years later?
Oh, that's a good question. I think sometimes in this role, and I think others at HSUS would say this something similar, we work with so many animals that it is important for us to pause sometimes and to look back and to remember so much collaborative hard work that went into things like this. And so I was really happy when you reached out to do this podcast because sometimes, as you mentioned in the beginning, these stories get a lot of attention initially, and then folks don't really talk about them. And it's helpful for our team to remember that this big thing happened, that the public stepped up in such big ways, that shelter partners, stepped up in big ways, that legislators are stepping up finally, and that together we're really making so much progress. And the individual dogs from this situation really represent a movement. And I think we can hold both joy that all of them have been given a different opportunity, much different than what they would have been exposed to, and remember that there are thousands of others that are just like them that we are going to continue to work for. I think that it is a mixture of joy and sadness about what has come of this. And at HSUS, we remain optimistic about all the issues we work on. We have seen so much progress on all fronts. And I think that because of the motivation of everybody involved, we're going to get there on this issue as well.
Thank you for joining me, your host, Ellie Hansen, for this latest episode of Dog Research Exposed. We are an independent nonprofit organization dedicated to using communication, education, and collaboration to end the cruel use of dogs for chemical and biomedical research. And we need your help to spread the word. We rely on donations to bring this podcast to larger audiences around the world. So please consider making a donation today at dogresearchexposed.com.